I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Stories of cities and the changes they endure over time always have something to teach us. Our guests today are at the forefront of change in two American cities, in two great neighborhoods. Bob Ury has, for 23 years, served as president of Central Houston, leading the redevelopment of the city's downtown. Today, he'll share the changes taking place there and in Greater Houston, and tell us about a major new park about to open downtown, Discovery Green. Sean Thomas is guiding the transition of Old North St. Louis, an urban village just 10 minutes from downtown St. Louis. Its conversion from a dying neighborhood with a decaying pedestrian mall at its center to a vibrant community is a story he'll share today on Smart City, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. For 23 years, Bob Ury has served as president of Central Houston, Inc., a nonprofit formed to lead the planning and implementation of the redevelopment of Houston's central city area, principally downtown. Bob is also executive director of the Houston Downtown Management District, a special assessment district within downtown Houston. Bob, describe Discovery Green.
Discovery Green is a 12-acre urban park set really right in the heart of the east side of downtown Houston. It's meant to be multifunctional in use, heavily programmed, two restaurants, events almost every day, if not every day, 24/7 almost, so that it really will create, you know, tremendous focal point of activity in Houston.
When you say heavily programmed, give me an example of what you mean.
Well, there is a performing space in it. Plus, there's an event lawn. There are special facilities adjacent to restaurants that are in the park. There's sort of a pedestrian street, if you will, promenade through it, and. So, you know, the types of events range from now there's going to be a farmer's market on Thursday afternoons, I'm told, to the performance events. Al Jarreau is actually already performed, believe it or not, even though the park is not already open at this point. But I think it gives you some idea of what's to come.
Some people would not think of Houston as much of a walking city. Is there enough traffic around Discovery Green to make it a place that you don't have to work too hard to get people to come to it?
In my sense is this is going to be an interesting test for us here in Houston. First of all, I think you're right about, and I think you're definitely right about Houston not being a walking city, even though really when you look at it climate-wise, we have many months of the year that one should be able to walk. My sense of this is that there is enough going on, whether it be employment, residential, special functions with two large sports facilities, convention center, several hotels in the area that there's enough population close enough that people really can, you know, will come and walk. On balance, I think we are hoping that there's a certain amount of traffic that really will see this as a destination and therefore may literally come to have a meal in one of the restaurants, or frankly, just sort of come to hang out, and you know that it'll be an interesting call as to which way this goes, whether it's more walk up versus sort of drive up activity.
Mm-hmm. When you think about 12 acres, it's hard for me to picture. I know the convention center fronts on the park, right?
The convention center fronts on the park on the east side. Actually, downtown's on the west side of the park. There's a 37-story residential tower that's under construction right now, which will open early next year. There's actually, as of literally the last couple of days here, there's a new 35-story, I believe I'm right on that, office tower that has started construction immediately to the north of it. We're working actually this week on plans for another convention-oriented, large headquarters-type hotel to the north, which would be sort of a sequel to one already that exists on the south side of the park. So the park is clearly attracted the interest of investors and the development community is sort of a place to be.
What is it about the park that you think interests developers to want to put buildings alongside it?
I think that this park is it's a sort of a new model for Houston. Certainly not unprecedented in our country at this point. Other cities, there are several wonderful examples of a park that really has a very high level of activity going on in it enough of the time that it's a great park to be. Houston, you know, it's a much more outdoor city than most people might realize, and you have a lot of recreational activity in parks, but I think that 12 acres is not large, but it's large enough that there's enough going on I think the developers looked at it, the development community sort of looked at it and said, you know, wow, this thing's really going to be sort of this engine, and while it will allow for sort of the relaxed green feel, it also has enough sort of space for human interaction and socialization that really will, you know, I really think will kind of set it apart from what the normal experience is in parks and open spaces in our city.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Bob Urey, president of Central Houston. Bob, I think many people also don't think of Houston as a downtown type of city. Early in its modern life, Houston decided it would be a city of multiple centers, but downtown seems to be developing in a very big way when you compare Houston to other downtowns. What would you say? How do you think Houston downtown compares to other cities?
I think we're a downtown that clearly, keep in mind that the growth in Houston really occurred primarily after World War II, and it occurred with the suburbia and the automobile, so it very quickly became suburban, literally a couple miles from downtown, and it's suburban from there for miles and miles and miles. What's really happened is as the city continues to grow, and it's at 5.5 million now, and the region's expected to reach about 8.5 million in the next 25, 30 years, clearly we're beginning to experience much higher level of density in inner city living, development, shopping, offices, you name it. In that process, downtown has been flourishing now for about, you know, 10 to 12 years. With literally all sectors really doing extraordinarily well. What happened with its footprint is that not only is it sort of redeveloped in many ways, there's not a whole lot of buildings left to be redeveloped. So we're now pretty much having to face building new buildings if we want growth in the downtown area, which is what's happening. But the area around Discovery Green, is an area that literally 20 years ago, just had the opening of the convention center and literally nothing around it. We were looking at some photos the other day of that. In fact, I think somewhat astonished because we had forgotten really how little was there, given what's going on today.
Wow. You know, as we talk about Houston and maybe some of the mythology attached to Houston, it's really an oversized city with an oversized story, it seems to me, in every way. What makes Houston, Houston? What's the essence of Houston?
Houston is a unique place, and actually, in my feeling, is it goes all the way back to the founding of the city by Augustus and John Allen in 1836. It was a real estate development, basically. It was meant to be a commercial emporium of what at that time was viewed as sort of inland, certainly from Galveston. But from the get-go, it was a city that was very open to people. It accepted people for sort of what they were, maybe not even what they had been, but what they can do. And therefore, it's very open to sort of new ideas and not sort of prejudging, accepting new people, new ideas. So that's one of the reasons why it's been so good in accepting sort of immigrant growth. And In many ways, that's really kind of led to the things that really worked about it. And as energy has come about, keep in mind there's a lot of exploration, there's a lot of risk-taking in that process. Again, very similar to the sort of original thinking, because keep in mind we were the frontier at that point in time. And so that risk-taking has, you know, carried into space, it's carried into medicine, it's carried into other areas as well, and of course it still exists in energy today. And so that type of sort of exuberance and sort of openness is really, I think, very much kind of a hallmark of what sort of powers the place today.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything intentional about maintaining that culture today, or does it simply exist from its own momentum?
It remarkably exists from its own momentum. It's also sort of interesting that I think most of us, even that live in this city, struggle a little bit to describe what that's all about, but we also realize it's a little bit of a unique sort of DNA that exists here that we don't find in other places, okay? We're going through, it is interesting because I think we're going through clearly a sense of wanting to become, we are knowing that we are becoming far more dense as an urban place. That is actually sort of challenging some of the notions in terms of quality of place, quality of space, and all of that. And as I think most listeners would know, we don't have zoning in Houston, although we actually have a good bit of regulation. But for the most part, we have a city that really embraces growth and development and renewal and sort of this sort of flourishing of sort of economic activity. And at the same time, you know, the older we get, the more we have older neighborhoods and whatever. So we're actually in a wonderful time right now. Some people may not think it's wonderful. I think it's actually really wonderful where we're now having a lot of debate about how we should be balancing, you know, frankly, the planning and regulation for growth and sort of the creation of quality place, protection of neighborhoods against a very open system of encouraging, embracing development in Houston.
Where do you think Houston will come out on that?
I think at this point, given where we've been in the discussions, and it's sometimes somewhat intense over the last few months, my sense is that there's a real sense of a need for middle ground. I think that those that cherish the most sort of the protection of neighborhoods and what we have also appreciate sort of the dynamism of the economy of Houston, its ability to grow. Many people have prospered from that. And I also think that on the part of the development community and those that are part of the growth and causing the growth, I think that there's a recognition that there needs to be a predictable system that you know, you can understand what the rules are here. We do have some respect for certain basic fundamental things that you just can't do from a development standpoint in terms of neighborhood protection and whatever. What happens in many ways here is without zoning, a lot of times you do not really have the vetting of a proposed development that one might have where a zoning variance might be required. And we again have ordinances here that affect development, so there is some before the Planning Commission, but I would dare say it's probably not quite what it is in many other cities in the country. And so I think that process of really kind of talking about how we grow in this, you know, in the nature of development in the future, may not have quite the debate that most cities have experienced over time. On balance, it's let development occur relatively easily here, and I think that's recognized as a characteristic that you don't want to, you know, that's not a bad characteristic to have because it's kept the it's made it more affordable, and so you know we're balancing a lot of these issues as we speak right now.
You said that Houston has always been open to people, and I know that Houston received so many of the Hurricane Katrina victims from New Orleans, and it seems like you did, and many of them haven't left. You did a good job of housing them quickly and taking care of them. What did you learn from that experience?
I think one thing we learned right off the bat was the city has a remarkable heart, and I think that the response fueled by our mayor Bill White and our county judge at that time Robert Eccles, I think that in a sense they initially showed leadership in saying we're gonna receive these people. We don't know all the answers at this point, but we'll take the risk and we'll work through it. And everybody really pitched in and made it work. I think it taught us that we can accept 150, 200,000 people rather quickly in a city this large, and we were able to find housing through an extraordinarily coordinated process in terms of kind of moving people from our convention centers and Astrodome, okay, to getting them into apartments. I think that longer term, it's worked at two levels. One, I think there's been an appreciation for the culture that has been brought to the community, and every day we see some little sign of a little bit more of the New Orleans or the Louisiana Gulf Coast culture being here. It's always been here. Keep in mind, they're our neighbors, but it's probably was heightened a little bit just because of the influx of folks. The other issue that has been difficult is that there has been some uptick in crime, and I think that that has caused some folks in the community to feel a little less comfortable about the ultimate, or put this way, what they're seeing today in terms of the outcome of this population that came in versus when they first arrived. And so it's to some extent sort of mixed feelings in terms of what's happened here, even though I think my sense is if we got thrown another storm and we were posed with the same question, this community would do exactly what it did in right at the end of August. It would take that population in again. I don't think that in my mind there's any doubt about it, even though, as I said, not everything is positive about that experience.
You mentioned Houston Mayor Bill White, and he has made a remarkable commitment to public transit. Tell me about it.
Well, White has recognized what I think many people who really appreciate public transit have recognized, and that is Houston was late getting started. We're operating a 7.5-mile light rail system in a most interesting corridor, really, which connects downtown through a midtown area, through an area with the museums and Rice University into the Texas Medical Center, which is a huge medical complex, on down to Reliant Stadium and Reliant Park. That system opened in the beginning of 2004. What White realized is we really need to accelerate the amount of miles in the coverage of that light rail system. And so Houston is actually working on 5 light rail corridors at the same time, some financed with federal funding, others financed with strictly local funding. And the idea literally is to break ground on all of them at once so that we would go from 7.5 miles to 35 miles of light rail, which would, in a sense, cover the high-density activity areas in the core of the city, including the Uptown Galleria area, the Texas Medical Center, downtown, the universities. And so, I think we have the possibility by 2012 of really being able to have a fixed guideway alternative to the automobile in a fairly good-sized footprint for the central part of the city. I need to be very careful, and there's still confusion here among many people about this rail system supposed to serve all. During the 1980s, Houston built a rather elaborate high-occupancy vehicle / busway system in virtually every direction, large number of park-and-ride lots and whatever. And so the fact of the matter is a longer-term suburban commute, a longer-distance commute, is really being met really by rubber tire. And in a sense, the light rail system is now becoming kind of the distributor, connector, circulator within a very large footprint of the central city.
And Houstonians will abandon their cars for public transit?
We're encouraged by the response on Main Street. My understanding is that the line that operates today per mile has some of the highest patronage of any city in America.
Wow.
And It's
who would have thought it?
Who would have thought it? What's exciting about that is it's not exactly like it hooks a lot of bedroom communities together with employment. You know, it's more one. There's a lot of either, you know, universities and medical schools and hospitals and, you know, office employment and some residential. I mean, museums, sports facilities. There's all kinds of stuff, so to speak, that are connected by the system. And you know, it's not when you do normal kind of transit planning 101, it's not exactly the kind of target that you would initially look for, because you tend to look from, you know, for home-based work, you know, type trips, you know. And so I think we're all very pleased with what's happened here, and I think it gives us a lot of confidence about what will happen with the expansion, which is really slated to actually start construction later this year.
That's amazing. Well, what do Houstonians worry about?
I think Houstonians worry about what people in most cities worry about when you really get down to it. I think we're more alike than we are dissimilar. Okay, you know, when you look at it right now, they probably are. We're starting with transit. I mean, they are concerned about issues of mobility that probably more affects the folks that live a little bit more toward the edges, the more suburban edges of the region, where you're clearly more vehicle dependent. There is clearly a continuing concern about issues of security and safety. Again, faces most cities. There's obviously a concern over the quality of jobs and the economy, even though, you know, we're probably faring a little better than most cities at this point in time. There is, I think, some concern over the quality of education that exists here, and that varies dramatically pretty much across the region by school district and area. I think leadership probably is more worried about the quality of higher education, knowing that that's so vital for the future. And we haven't said, we said a little bit, we started with the park, but really when you get down to it, the quality of life issues, the quality of public space, parks and open space are all very, very significant issues. As I look back on it 20, 25 years, the thing that excites me about Houston is there's a much, 25 years ago, there was a much higher value really probably placed on the fact that this is just a place to work. Most people came here because of work-related, you know, they came here for a job. And what's happened is that over the period of time, including the downturn with the oil bust in the mid to late 80s, I think there was a strong commitment on the part of many people sort of saying, we want to improve the quality of life of Houston. And it led to much more civic engagement on the part of many, many people. And what always impresses me now is that I could easily count on one hand the groups, let's say, that were involved in green initiatives, you know, 20 years ago. And at this point, there's no way you can begin, you know, and I can't even begin to count them all, you know, at this point. It's everywhere. And I think it's sort of indicative of kind of what's really happening with the mindset in this region.
Bob Urey is president of Central Houston. After a short break, we'll continue our conversation with Bob Urey, check in with Nate Berg at Plan Edison, and talk to Sean Thomas of Old North St. Louis Restoration Group. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. For 23 years, Bob Urey has served as president of Central Houston, Inc., a nonprofit formed to lead the planning and implementation of the redevelopment of Houston's central city area. In so many communities, the business civic engagement has fallen away. I mean, in a lot of cases, that's because of mergers and consolidations. And instead of CEOs, you have branch managers running businesses in a lot of major cities today. Houston, of course, still is home to a lot of headquarters firms. I'm curious, Bob, how do you keep your business community engaged?
give them jobs. That's a quick answer.
Okay. That's good.
But I think it varies. You have two types of CEOs. Obviously, I think there's a lot stronger sense of being very, very responsive to the shareholders, okay? But I think that in the old days, I think we did see, you know, some CEOs that were far more, I think, risk-taking in terms of being able to kind of say, I'll engage in civic leadership. It's so important to change the environment we're located in, whatever. I see a mix of that today. I see this sort of, you know, whether the needle points more towards sort of civic engagement, more towards the shareholders and the bottom line, so to speak. I've got a very narrow focus of what I'm working on. I am serious. I mean, the engagement of the CEOs is tremendously important. And thank goodness we have a number of folks that really are very committed to the city. They either grew up here or they've been here a while or they've kind of fallen in love with it, and they really have engaged in it. And the other thing is that the breadth, you know, it was at one point it was sort of all energy companies, and I think it's moved a little bit more now where it's in more diverse disciplines that we see corporate leadership engagement. And I wouldn't say it's without some worry on our part. I think there's sort of two levels of civic engagement. There are almost like heroic leaders, maybe, that are a little bit bigger than life. And then, you know, there are others who are really great at what they do, but probably, you know, in the test of time, stand among many. And we probably right now, when we really look at the way the city's performing, we're probably the stand among many, which I actually think is probably a better way to be. In terms of the breadth of all the different initiatives that are underway.
Mm-hmm. And when you look ahead at Houston's future, what do you think are its biggest opportunities?
Well, the opportunities that are out there are this is a city, as I said earlier, that is really embraces people who choose to move to this city, regardless of who you are. And my sense is we're just beginning to really tap the energy of what that brings, and we will get even stronger here in the future when we realize sort of the sort of power of the diversity of the population that's here. Keep in mind, a lot of that was accelerated in this community because of energy. The roots in this city are worldwide. Because, you know, so many of the energy companies and industry all around that has operations around the globe. And so, you know, this is not like it just happened yesterday. This is something that's been around for quite a few years. And so, I'd say that is, very powerful. The other thing is, I said a little earlier too, is the city is beginning more and more to really place a value on quality of place and quality of life, and is, in my mind, working harder and harder to really improve quality of place, and it's beginning to kind of show up. You know, again, it's kind of one of those things where you have to think back a few years to kind of remember what it was like, and maybe nowadays we kind of take some things for granted. But Discovery Green being a wonderful example, but in many ways I could go on just naming on and on and on a list of other examples of in our community where really great things are happening in terms of making Houston a far more public space and place-oriented type community. And the importance of the pedestrian realm, the quality of neighborhoods, quality of parks, quality of open space, and sort of transit versus sort of automobile orientation, sort of all the things that really kind of help create a really strong urban place.
When you talk about the opportunities and you mention the power of diversity and the recognition of that, when you hold a civic meeting today in Houston, do you see many Latinos, for instance?
I think the answer really is more and more. And it varies group to group. But it is in my mind very clearly it's very much generational too that the younger leadership becomes the more diverse it is in this community. And so a lot of that almost depends on the age of the group, but you know, it's clearly more and more. One of the other things that's happened here too is that diversity and ethnic location in this community is, yes, there is a Chinatown. There's multiple Chinatowns in Houston, okay, but just as an example. But the fact of the matter is, when you really look at the population, it's remarkably mixed all over the region, literally from the very edge of the region to the very, you know, core of downtown, in terms of sort of which ethnic groups live where, okay? And that again, I think, is kind of a hallmark of the city.
Mm-hmm. And one more question. When does Discovery Green officially open?
Discovery Green opens officially on April 13th. I just walked by it a little while ago, and it's starting to green up. You know, Houston is pretty green compared to many places in America during the wintertime. But even for us, you know, as we move through March into April, things really start to get, you know, become much more spring-like. And it's really starting to show it.
Thanks, Bob. This was fun.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you all today.
The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planetizen and assistant editor, Nate Berg.
It seems like the French may be onto something. Last summer, they unveiled a citywide bike-sharing program in Paris that has placed thousands of rental bikes and stations on the streets of the French capital. The system has been such a success that cities across the globe are looking to follow its lead, including the American capital, Washington, D.C. Oregon Congressman Earl Blumenauer recently proposed a bike-sharing program for congressional employees on Capitol Hill. According to the Oregonian, Blumenauer proposed the program to try to cut down on the high amount of short trips made by congressional staffers, mostly in cars. The bike-sharing program, dubbed Wheels for Wellness, is one of the first copycat systems in the U.S. to follow on the heels of the Paris bike-sharing system, a system that boasts a fleet 20,000 strong. But in the U.S., catching up may take a while. The Capitol Hill program is expected to start out with a fleet of 30. Meanwhile, in Los Angeles, public art is coming under fire as city officials are targeting murals around the city for removal. A recent segment on the radio program Which Way LA discussed how the city's Department of Building and Safety is canvassing neighborhoods throughout the city to find and condemn wall paintings and murals, calling them illegal signs. The city plans to paint over all unapproved signs, including many intricate and well-loved murals. Many in the city are opposed to the move, claiming the city's actions are an attack on the distinct cultural landmarks that help define many of the city's ethnic enclaves. But despite protests from civic leaders, residents, and artists, the city plans to move forward with its mural removal. Whether art or not, they say, illegal signs are still illegal. And finally, the city of San Francisco has qualified a ballot initiative that would require half of the homes built as part of a major redevelopment project to be priced affordably. The ballot initiative is aimed at a 10,000-unit redevelopment project in the city's Bayview-Hunters Point area, and is being seen as a major win for affordable housing advocates. The San Francisco Chronicle reports that 5,000 of the proposed units would have to be priced for residents earning between 30 and 80% of the city's median income, if it is approved by voters in the June election. Lennar Corporation, the project's developer, says this measure could kill the project outright. Lennar has proposed a watered-down version of the initiative requiring only 25% affordable pricing, but backers of the 50% plan are pushing forward. And with the initiative now set to appear on the ballot, they've just got to convince the public to go along. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Sean Thomas is the executive director of Old North St. Louis Restoration Group, a neighborhood-based, not-for-profit community development corporation. Previously, Sean worked for the St. Louis Association of Community Organizations for 11 years, 5 as a community organizer and the last 6 as deputy director. Sean also has worked as a community organizer in Detroit, Michigan, and the community initiatives coordinator for East-West Gateway Coordinating Council. Sean, tell me the story of Old North St. Louis. What is it that makes the neighborhood special?
Well, the Old North St. Louis neighborhood is just north of downtown St. Louis, about a mile and a half north of the Gateway Arch, and about a half mile from the Mississippi River. So we've got some major landmarks not far from the neighborhood boundaries here. The community itself, though, has a history that dates back to 1816, when it was established as a separate village from the city of St. Louis. From 1816 to 1841, it grew rapidly and eventually got absorbed by the city of St. Louis in what you might consider a mid-19th century version of sprawl. It got absorbed into the city of St. Louis, is now one of 79 neighborhoods in the city, and has a really fascinating history of its evolution from that small village to the urban neighborhood that it became, and experienced rapid growth and incredible densely populated old city blocks, and then went through rather rapid decline by the mid-20th century. And then the past 10, 15 years or so, been starting to experience an incredible resurgence.
What stimulated the resurgence?
Well, it started with the people who lived here. As genuine community development should be, the people who lived in this community had been basically hanging on for a while. A lot of the residents here had been preserving their own homes, trying to rehab what they owned, and then gradually started recognizing that unless they worked together, unless they found a way to collaborate with each other, the rest of the neighborhood was going to collapse around them. So they started this organization about 27 years ago. And then in the course of those 27 years, the Old North St. Louis Restoration Group evolved from just a collection of volunteers to the powerhouse that we are, of three full-time staff persons and a budget of about $300,000 to $450,000, depending on the year and depending on the various activities that we have.
So the people of the neighborhood got together on a volunteer basis to collaborate with one another to save their neighborhood. Where did they begin?
Well, they started with a few things, like simple things like community cleanups of vacant lots and working together to help access home improvement loans and even working together to help repair their houses, with almost like the spirit of a small town barn raising, where residents shared their knowledge, shared their experience, and helped each other out. From that, it grew to an organization that gradually got some grant dollars and gradually got some support from other outside sources to hire professional full-time staff. And that was about 10 years ago that they actually hired the first time staff person. From there, though, it still was a while before they were able to have the resources to do some serious community planning and start doing some acquisition of properties.
Why was it, do you think, that this group of people in Old North St. Louis came together to save their neighborhood when that hasn't happened in so many other places? What was there something special about the neighborhood, about the people, about their circumstances? I'm just curious, what was it that you think may have led them to come together to make, you know, this neighborhood a more vital neighborhood?
Well, I think a few factors came together there. One is that there was a population of residents who had been here for a long time who stayed put and decided that this was their community and they weren't going to see it collapse. And they were just passionate about preserving the neighborhood where they lived, or in some cases where they had several generations that have gone before them within their same family. This neighborhood did have a rather diverse population base from its earliest days. There are residents who are here today who are active, whose families go back five generations here in this community. But there are also people who've come into the neighborhood because they really desired to be part of a diverse community, a community that had people who didn't necessarily look like them, didn't necessarily come from the same income bracket, didn't necessarily worship the same faith, but they wanted to be part of a community that had incredible diversity like that. So that was a big factor. Another piece was that the residents here had seen other neighborhoods in the city of St. Louis undergo similar revitalizations earlier, so they knew it was possible. The neighborhood here has a tremendous architectural and historic character to the housing stock. Unfortunately, a lot of the buildings have been lost over the decades of disinvestment and depopulation. But what's left is rather striking and rather attractive. So that was a good building block. But the fact that there were a lot of empty lots meant that there's opportunity for some new construction that could blend in with the character of the urban character of the neighborhood, that could be designed in a way that was either more affordable or at least a little more contemporary, but it provided a number of opportunities there.
Mm-hmm. You said that people moved to or wanted to save this neighborhood because they intentionally wanted to live with people who were not like them, didn't share their color or their beliefs or their backgrounds. There are not many Americans like that today. I've got a colleague, Bill Bishop, with the Austin American Statesman, who has a book coming out this spring called The Big Sort. And in it, he shows that we increasingly are living next door to, in the same block, with people who indeed share our beliefs, our political party, that Americans truly are sorting themselves. I mean, do people really move to Old North or stay in Old North because of the diversity?
Well, perhaps it's a small niche of the overall population. I wish I could say that we're bursting at the seams because there's so many people who desire that. We still have a long way to go, and the neighborhood is in the early stages of its resurgence still. I said it's been going on for about 10 to 15 years, but there's still a lot of empty gaps here, still a lot of work that has to be done to repopulate the neighborhood to a level of full sustainability. But I would say there is a portion of the population out there, and we certainly are attracting a portion of that portion that do want to be part of a community like this.
Mm-hmm.
And we surely have our share of detractors out there who think that the people who are moving into this neighborhood or think that anybody would consider moving into this neighborhood must be absolutely crazy. But the folks who are here enjoy the quality of life of that diversity and the great great variety of culture that brings.
What have been the struggles with redevelopment?
Well, the greatest struggle is just convincing people who are outsiders who don't give the neighborhood a chance to grow on them.
How do you do that?
Well, we host a number of events that try to bring people into the community, an annual house tour and other activities just to show that there is a population of people who live here in the neighborhood who are not scary, who do have options, some of whom could live anywhere in the region but chose to live here, who have beautiful homes that have been restored, just to open people's minds to show them what is possible. But the other issue is that we do have, within the neighborhood, a landmark restaurant that does attract people from outside the neighborhood by the hundreds every day. And a lot of those people, up until recently, would come into this restaurant and sometimes wait in the line that stretches outside the door of the restaurant, and they'd look across the street and see what looked like a ghost town. Well, we're currently in the midst of a $35 million redevelopment of what had been a failed pedestrian mall right across the street from Crown Candy Kitchen, which is that landmark restaurant that has been here since 1913. So we are in the process of transforming people's perspectives just by having them come into this restaurant. And instead of just hopping back into the car and getting out as quickly as they can, they have a chance to see that there is revitalization in progress.
How in the world did you get a pedestrian mall 10 minutes outside of downtown? I worked at the pedestrian mall early in my career, and you know, most of them have been absolutely deadly. Most of them have been converted back to streets. And so how did that happen?
Well, it actually was put in the 70s. And
of course.
From our research, there were about 200 pedestrian malls installed in various urban areas across the country in the 70s, and most of them did fail miserably for a variety of factors. This one here really was a case study of how not to do it, really. it did fail. The commercial strip along 14th Street was in a state of decline for a number of years, some would say decades. And the pedestrian mall, by closing off the two-block stretch, was an attempt to revive it, and it actually ended up being the cure that killed the patient.
Sean, as I listen to Barack Obama's biography, it talks about his work as a community organizer. You've been a community organizer for many years. What does that really mean? What do you do? What's the job description?
Well, in my mind, the community organizer's job is to work with a group of people in a geographic community when it comes to neighborhood organizing, but could be other types of community. But to work with a group of people to help them identify what they want to achieve and help them find a way to get to that outcome. In my experience, usually is a five-step process. The first step is identifying the issues or challenges that the community wants to address. Second step involves establishing goals to be achieved. And third step means developing strategies for helping to achieve those goals. And then the fourth step is implementing and then ultimately evaluating after that to see if it's working. And then if it's not working or if it is, you go back toward the top and fine-tune to see what a new approach might be or a way to expand it if it is a successful effort. So ultimately it's really working with people, listening to them, helping them to verbalize and identify together what they want to see happen, and working with them along the process to make that happen.
And who tends to fund community organizers?
Well, there unfortunately isn't enough funding out there for that, so there isn't as much community organizing going on that I'd like to see. But in my experience, it has usually come from a variety of places, including community residents themselves often pitch in through membership in a neighborhood association or some other sources. But a lot of times it is dependent on support from foundation, and sometimes even corporate support. Some charitable funds of corporations that are friendly to a particular community that have an interest in a stable community there. Sometimes it comes from some public dollars through a local government or sometimes a state or federal agency that might have some funding for a particular initiative, and as part of that initiative there's a staff person assigned to it whose job it is to mobilize the community to get engaged. And sometimes it's just through knitting together little bits and pieces through fundraisers, such as even simple as bake sales.
You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. City View's commentator Walker Smith has a story of how reimagining an even older form of transportation than railroad has transformed Augusta, Georgia.
The Augusta Canal runs a parallel track to a stretch of the Savannah River, from which it borrows its flow to make its way through the river town of Augusta, Georgia. The Savannah River is the border between South Carolina and Georgia. In the 19th century, the small rapids around Augusta kept commercial boat traffic from reaching town. So between 1845 and 1850, the Augusta Canal was built to bypass these rapids. The canal transformed Augusta, attracting textile mills and iron works. The assurance of power and transportation persuaded the government of the Confederate States of America to locate the Confederate Powder Works in Augusta. After the Civil War, the Augusta Canal continued to attract industry and investors, enabling Augusta to sidestep much of the post-war hardship that plagued the rest of the South. Hydroelectric power from the falling water of the canal powered electric streetcars and streetlights in Augusta, the first city in the South to enjoy these modern amenities. Eventually, though, time took its toll on the canal. Despite extensive repairs to fix the damage caused by major floods in the 20s and 30s, the canal eventually fell into disrepair as textile mills closed and industrial growth moved to other parts of the city and the region. By the 1960s, the canal was so run down that city planners considered draining it and using the dry bed for a major highway. Interest in the canal began to revive in the 70s and 80s. In 1989, the state legislature created the Augusta Canal Authority, which, in 1993, completed a master plan for redevelopment. In 1996, the U.S. Congress designated the Augusta Canal as one of America's national heritage areas. Today, the levees and spillways of the upper portion of the old Augusta Canal form an 8.5-mile-long public park filled with walkways, bicycle paths, and picnic shelters that are used for everything from church cookouts to private weddings. Kayakers and canoeists paddle the peaceful waters of the canal itself. Recently, my friend Max and I, along with our wives, spent one bright weekend morning paddling the length of the canal. Our paddle took us through a place of pure tranquility and repose, which I did not expect. The canal borders the city and is crossed at one point by I-20. Yet between its banks, the Augusta Canal is a pocket of serenity. As we dreamily floated the canal, we saw a teeming diversity of wildlife. Flowering plants of every color, as well as river otters, herons, and a surfeit of sunning turtles. Perhaps it reflects our schizophrenic nature that a slice of wilderness can be so easily reclaimed right next door to our civilized cities and streets. It is certainly ironic that an artificial waterway built for industry and commerce is now an escape from these very things. But it is encouraging, too. For it means that we still care about a balanced way of life, even if we can't or won't live that way often enough. It is, at least, a start. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. His latest book is Generation Ageless. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.